Many crime authors write made-up stories from the dark depths of their imagination. While some authors write fantastical stories based on real criminal events, and others tell the true, detailed stories of a crime with factual evidence from court records. One author wrote his stories with a different approach. Unknown to his readers, he was the one actually committing the crimes, and he did not spare a single gruesome detail. Gerard Schaefer's stories were marketed as fiction. However, in hindsight, some believe his stories were the truth about how he killed a number of his alleged victims. The true crime author was the true criminal. A lot of true crime writing lacks authenticity. The protagonist is a voyeur in their own story. The authors are usually good people who can boast that they've not done anything worse than accidentally run a red light. The main problem with criminals is that they're typically too compulsive and uneducated to lend an articulate voice to their crimes. Gerard Schaefer masqueraded his nauseating graphic murder tales as fiction. He was convicted of 2 murders, suspected by authorities of more than 24, and frequently boasted that his death toll was higher than 80. The sufferers in all of his plots were women, and his stories were used as evidence to prove his level of culpability, with titles like Flies in Her Eyes, Whores, What to Do About Them, and Blonde on a Stick. His stories were based off of murders he committed, but the exact wording can't be placed to exact crimes. His published books, Killer Fiction and Beyond Killer Fiction, gave the idea that these were real accounts from the actual murderer. They were all real, no matter how much the names and places had been changed. He continued his writing behind bars. Some stories that he wrote were true accounts, while others were part of his dark fantasies. In one of his stories, simply titled Whores, he reminisces about hanging a prostitute and having sex with her corpse. In another story named Spring Break, he tells a story of fatally stabbing and disemboweling a co-ed during sex. Which of these are real and which are fiction? It's hard to tell with a mind as dark as Schaefer's. What made Schaefer this way? Was he always this dark soul, wanting and needing to kill? Gerard Schaefer was born on March 25th, 1946, in Wisconsin, and then raised in Atlanta, Georgia. He was the first child of 3 to Gerard John Schaefer Sr. and Doris Marie Runcie. His family permanently relocated to Florida in 1960. Schaefer described his childhood as troubled and turbulent, mostly because of his family's frequent relocations. His father was also an alcoholic and was often verbally abusive to his wife and children. His father's frequent absences also made Gerard Jr. weary of his father, and he also felt that his father liked his sister more, and the constant belittling cemented those thoughts. This made it so Gerard became closer with his mother, and Doris was extremely protective of her children. When Schaefer was a child, he preferred outdoor activities. This love of the outdoors turned into an interest in nature, and he collected guns and loved to hunt and fish. These activities he would share with his father when he was home and not being abusive. Gerard wasn't really a loner growing up, but his classmates would say that he was not part of any clique. He would often pursue his interests alone, and he was viewed as an outdoorsman, and they believed he would become a forest ranger. When Schaefer was just 12, he would tie himself to a tree and, quote, "I'd get excited sexually and do something to hurt myself." The violent self-loathing went back to his earliest childhood games. "In these games," he says, "I always got killed. I wanted to die. My father favored my sister, so I wanted to be a girl. I was such a disappointment to my family. To my father, he loved my sister. I couldn't please my father, so in playing games, I always wanted to be killed." By the time Schaefer was a teen, he had developed erotic fantasies of hurting women who he thought were worthy of his contempt. These fantasies evolved into sadomasochism and bondage. He would always wear women's underwear until he reached orgasm via autoerotic asphyxiation. These fantasies would increase in terms of frequency and intensity with time, gradually dominating many of his waking hours. Schaefer also became a peeping Tom in his mid-teens and developed the habit of cross-dressing. His female classmates viewed him with disdain. Barbara Krolik, a former classmate, later recalled, "I can't remember him being friends with any of the guys. He was always on the outside looking in. As a matter of fact, the only thing I really remember is that I always had to tuck my skirt under my legs because he would practically stand on his head to look up a girl's skirt." Although his social life was not very social, his teachers would call him a promising student. He was a member of the varsity football team during his sophomore and junior years, and he is known to have been an excellent golfer. When he graduated from St. Thomas Aquinas High School in June of 1964, he briefly worked as a fishing guide in the Everglades before enrolling at Broward Community College. While at Broward, he started as a social studies major, but in September of 1964, he switched to teaching. Upon completion of his sophomore year at Broward, he applied for and was accepted for a scholarship at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton, where he began his studies in 1968 with aspirations to obtain a Bachelor of Arts in Education. In December of 1968, Schaefer married his fiancée, Martha Louise Fogg, a fellow FAU student. She was 2 years younger than him, and they had met at Broward. Their relationship soon soured, both due to Schaefer's incessant demands for sex and his spending much of his free time hunting. Gerard and Martha divorced on May 2nd, 1970. She cited his extreme cruelty as the reason for their separation. Gerard worked as a teacher for a time. He was not successful in this. He was hard-headed and didn't accept advice from his superiors and co-workers. He was also underqualified and had very limited knowledge on the subject he taught. He was only a teacher for a little over a year. His next endeavor was becoming a police officer. He started as a security guard with the Wackenhut Corporation. But on September 1st, 1970, he applied for a vacancy within the Wilton Manors Police Department. He did not disclose that he had twice been fired from teaching positions and falsely claimed to have acquired 2 years of experience as a research assistant at FAU. They did not verify his work history, and he was formally inducted into the Broward County Police Department in September of 1971. He graduated as a patrolman at the end of the year at the age of 25. While Schaefer was still working as a security guard in 1971, he met a 19-year-old secretary named Teresa Dean. They married in September of that year. This marriage was more harmonious because Teresa gave in to his demands for sex, and she also shared his passion for fishing in locations such as the Florida Keys. Schaefer only lasted 6 months at the Wilton Manors Police Department. His performance was considered poor, although he did receive accommodation from his superiors in March of 1972 for his actions during a raid on a drug house. He was dismissed from his position when his superiors discovered his habit of stopping cars driven by females who committed minor traffic infractions. He would enter the license plate numbers into a database to obtain personal details about them before contacting them to request dates. Our writer police officer wasn't as slick as he may have thought. He was overconfident in his position as an officer. On July 21st, 1972, Schaefer encountered two teenage hitchhikers named Nancy Ellen Trotter and Paula Sue Wells, aged 18 and 17 respectively. He drove the two girls to their destination while scolding them about the dangers of hitchhiking. Once he learned that neither girl was native to Florida, and that the two were intending to travel to Jensen Beach, Schaefer proposed to drive them there himself. The girls accepted the offer and agreed to meet him at a bandstand on East Ocean Boulevard at 9:15 a.m. The next morning, Schaefer met up with the girls as agreed upon. He was not wearing his uniform, and he was driving his own car. Despite these facts, he told the girls he was still on duty. He told them he was undercover and driving an unmarked car. Not long after departing, Schaefer deviated from their intended route. He told them he wanted to show them an old Spanish fort. He also continued to lecture the girls about hitchhiking and accepting rides from random strangers, and told them that they could be sold into white slavery. He finally ended up stopping by a dilapidated shed deep inside a remote forest, where he handcuffed and gagged the girls. He took one of the girls to a large cypress tree close to the Indian River. He tied her legs to the trunk just below her knees before binding a noose around her neck. The other end of the rope was tied to a branch in such a manner as to force her to stand on the exposed roots to counter the pressure from the noose. Schaefer then took the other girl to another tree, where she was bound in a similar manner. Both girls were told that he was going to rape and kill them. Just at that moment, Schaefer received an urgent radio dispatch telling him to report back to the police station immediately. He had no choice but to leave the girls bound and gagged while he had responded to the call. He threatened both girls that he would soon return and that he was to confer with the individual that he was intending to sell them to. The girls, of course, escaped. When Schaefer returned to the forest almost 2 hours later, he made the discovery of their escape. Panicked, he immediately returned home and called his station, where he spoke to Sheriff Robert Crowder. He told the sheriff, "I've done something very foolish. You'll be mad at me." Schaefer then downplayed what he had done and explained that he was trying to teach the girls a lesson on the risks of hitchhiking, but that he overdid the job. He then explained that he had abandoned the girls in the swampland near Hutchinson Island, not far from the Indian River. The sheriff and Lieutenant Melvin Waldron immediately proceeded to Florida State Road A1A, where they discovered a desperate, partially gagged teenage girl with her hands tied behind her back, swimming via a flutter kick in a river. As the officer slowed to a halt, they observed the distraught girl clamber from the riverbank with sections of her jeans and blouse shredded, attempting to get their attention. They removed the gag from the girl's mouth, and she identified herself as Nancy, and told them that her friend was somewhere in the forest. It was brought to her attention that her friend had escaped the forest and flagged down a truck driver and was already brought to the station 45 minutes earlier. Both girls told the story of how Schaefer abducted them, tied them up, and left them. They explained how they escaped and how they had to carefully loosen the rope because one slip and they would have been hanged. Schaefer, of course, repeated his innocence and that he was trying to teach them a lesson, but his story was not believed. He was dismissed from the force and placed under arrest for false imprisonment and aggravated assault. While out on bail, he returned to the house that he and his second wife had rented. His wife and in-laws reported no change in his demeanor, meaning that they really believed that he was trying to teach them a lesson. Then, on September 27th, 1972, Schaefer struck again. He abducted two teenage friends named Susan Carol Place, age 17, and Georgia Marie Jessup, age 16. The three of them were attending an adult education center in Fort Lauderdale, and that's where they met. He told the girls that he went by the name of Jerry and that he was from Colorado. He said he intended to return there after a trip to Mexico. He feigned interest in the reincarnation and ESP, which Jessup was interested in. He was trying to integrate himself with both the girls and gain their trust. On the afternoon of their disappearance, Susan's mother, Lucille, arrived home to find her daughter straightening her room as Georgia sat upon a chair in the bedroom. Both girls introduced Lucille to a man in his 20s, whom they referred to as Jerry. Susan told her mother that she intended to travel to Fort Lauderdale with Jerry to go to the beach and play guitar. Lucille was a bit suspicious, but Jerry assured her his intentions were innocent. And even though Jerry had calmed her nerves a little, she still made note of his vehicle, a 1969 Datsun. Susan told her mother that she would be gone just for a little while, but she would remain in contact with her, The girls and Jerry left the home at 8:45 p.m. When Susan had not returned after 4 days, Lucille first contacted George's mother, Shirley, only to learn that her daughter had run away on September 27th. Because of this, the girls were reported missing to the Oakland Park Police. Lucille provided a vehicle registration and a physical description of this man named Jerry. The registration was traced to a St. Petersburg resident who did not resemble Jerry Shepard, and they had a firm alibi for the date of the girl's disappearance. The only Jerry Shepard registered as living in Fort Lauderdale was also eliminated by police inquiries, and by early 1973, the teenager's disappearance had largely become a cold case. Criminal AF Direct. We'll be back after this quick break.
Hello Fresh!
With Hello Fresh, you get farm fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit.
Dave, I can't tell you how many times my kids have been like, Daddy, can you just cook something good for once? And I don't even tell them it's HelloFresh. And then They're like, wow, you're a better cook than Mom.
Oh, got them.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's easy. You don't have to go to the grocery store. It's shipped right to your door. So it's a no-brainer for me. And you're still spending less with HelloFresh.
Absolutely.
HelloFresh does more than just delicious dinners. Not only can you take your pick from 40 weekly recipes, but you can choose from over 100 items to round out your order. From snacks and easy lunches to desserts and pantry necessities, everything arrives in one box on a delivery day you choose.
When I got my box, I got the three-meal box, right? But I'm single, so I eat alone. Table for one, you know. I actually took my meals and I portioned them out for the week.
A little meal prep,
you know what I mean? So I got three dinners and I turned them each into 5 meals each. So that's 15 meals.
Come on.
You can't beat it. And it's like Garrett said, it's less than what you would spend in a grocery store. Mm-hmm. And you know what? You don't even have to worry if you're not a pro in the kitchen. HelloFresh's foolproof recipes arrive pre-portioned and easy to prepare in just a few steps.
No more scouring the grocery store for that one ingredient to complete your recipe. HelloFresh takes away all the hassle by delivering fresh, pre-portioned ingredients so you have exactly what you need and helps you cut down on food waste. And let me tell you, that fry seasoning that they throw in that box is
fire. So HelloFresh cares about quality, and that's why their seasonal ingredients are picked at peak ripeness and travel from the farm to your home in less than 7 days, so you know that what you're getting is fresh. So go to HelloFresh.com/CriminalAF16 and use code CriminalAF16 for 16 free meals plus free shipping.
Go to HelloFresh.com/CriminalAF16 and use code CriminalAF16 for 16 free meals plus free shipping.
America's number one meal kit.
Ta-da! Now back to the episode. Mary Alice Briscolina, 14, and Elsie Lena Farmer, 13, vanished while hitchhiking to a Commercial Boulevard restaurant from a Lauderdale-by-the-Sea motel in October 26, 1972, less than 1 month after Susan and Georgia were last seen alive. Their bodies were separately recovered in undergrowth close to Sunrise Boulevard early the following year. Both girls' legs were spread apart. Mary Alice had been beaten about the head, with one fatal blow recorded. Many of her fingernails had been torn from her body, implying a hard fight against her killer. Elsie had been bludgeoned to death. The police questioned Mary's friends, and it was revealed that the girls would often visit a Lauderdale-by-the-Sea apartment rented by the older sister of Mary's boyfriend, and that an individual by the name of Gary Shepard had been known to Mary. 3 months later, Colette Marie Goodenough and Barbara Ann Wilcox, both 19, disappeared while hitchhiking from Sioux City, Iowa to Florida. Both were last seen alive in Biloxi, Mississippi. Their disappearance occurred while Schaefer remained free prior to the beginning of his sentence for the abduction of Trotter and Wells. Their skeletal remains were discovered scattered close to a large tree in an orange crate in January of 1977. Both victims had been bound together with baling wire, and impressions on the tree branches indicated that one or both victims had been suspended from the tree as their murderer sat or stood upon the orange crate. In March of 1973, Lucille Place discovered a letter written by Jerry Shepard in her daughter's bedroom. She drove to the return address that appeared on the letter, 333 Martin Avenue in Stuart, Florida, only to learn from the building manager that Jerry Shepard had registered at the property under his real name, Gerard Schaefer. Lucille also revisited the car registration that she had provided to the police. She realized that she assumed the car was registered in Pinellas County rather than Martin County. Having the police run the plate from Martin County, it was found that the car was registered as a blue-green Datsun that happened to be registered to Gerard Schaefer, who resided at 333 Martin Avenue. A father and son were searching for discarded aluminum cans and discovered extensively decomposed remains of two individuals scattered around a hole dug among trees in Old Hammock Park in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Deep scratch marks were evident upon the base of the tree, close to where sections of a torso had been bound to the base of a trunk. One victim wore the remnants of blue jeans with a circular emblem of the Roadrunner. The other body was completely nude, with a pile of clothes laying nearby in the undergrowth. The location of this discovery was 6 miles from where Trotter and Wells had been held captive prior to their escape the previous summer. Both girls had been bound and murdered, and their spinal cords were severed at the lumbar and cervical section, and several bones were completely severed with a knife or machete. Their heads had been decapitated after death, and their jawbones sustained numerous fractures. One set of remains, later identified as Susan Place, had also sustained a gunshot wound to her lower jaw, consistent with a .22 caliber pistol. There was evidence to show that both bodies were suspended from the tree, and the initials GJ had been carved into the tree trunk. Inside a locked bedroom at the Fort Lauderdale residence of Schaefer's mother, police found 300 pages of lurid stories, some including crude drawings Schaefer had penned and typed over the course of several years. These stories detailed the kidnapping, humiliation, rape, and execution by hanging of a number of teenage girls and young women whom he routinely referred to as whores, sluts, and harlots, including two named Belinda and Carmen, and an unidentified woman who he graphically describes hanging at an unknown location close to Powerline Road. The following story I will read was in Schaefer's possession when he was brought in for questioning. This story is extremely graphic. Listener discretion is advised. She was expecting dinner, but instead was driven down a deserted road. She was asked to get out of the car and submitted to a frisk search. Then the handcuffs were locked around her wrists and the blindfold placed over her eyes. She was then led away into the dark to the place of execution. She was assisted in mounting the ladder and sat down on top of it. The hangman's noose was placed over her head after a pillowcase was dropped over her face in a hood arrangement. She sat there very composed and ladylike while I adjusted the rope. She obviously had no inclination of what was about to happen. I told her some stories about Vietnam and then told her I had to make a radio call. I warned her that if she made a sound, that she would be hanged immediately. I went back to the car and had something to drink. I got out and tied the rope to the bumper so that if I pulled away, it would pull out the ladder from beneath her, and she would be left hanging. I went back to see her and asked if she was comfortable. She replied that she was getting bored, and would I please hurry up with whatever business I had to attend to. I said I would, and before I went back to the car, I made sure that the rope was tight around her neck. She sat there very ladylike in a black chiffon dress with her hair done up and black pantyhose and high heels. She was wearing perfume and was very sexy. I went back to the car and finished off the bottle of wine, and then promptly at 9 p.m., I started the car and backed up quickly. I turned off the car and got out, straining to see if the branches were moving in the trees or if there were any other sounds. There were none. After 15 minutes, which I judged to be a sufficient time for her to die. I went slowly forward into the grave of trees where the execution site was arranged. It was nothing more than a rope with a hangman's noose over a limb, dangling above the ladder where she was to sit. I had a light, but I almost didn't want to see what I was responsible for. I approached in the dark and could make out her body turning slowly suspended from the tree. I went forward and turned the light. I was a little shocked. There was a considerable amount of blood staining the white pillowcase hood that was over her head. The noose was pulled tight around her neck, and her head was tilted to the side because I had placed the noose beneath her left chin. When I was within a few feet of her body, I could see that where her feet had been tied tightly, that she had broken the bounds obviously in her violent death throes. One of her high heels was kicked off. I was probably shaking as I slowly ran my hand up under her dress just above her knees and began to work upward. I felt a big hard growing in my pants as my hand traveled up her legs, still warm and very much alive to me. The inside of her thighs were wet where she had urinated in her panties. Her underpants and pantyhose were soaked. She was wearing her pantyhose over her panties that were white nylon mesh and very skimpy. I lifted her dress and her wet slip and pulled down the pantyhose over the back of her backside, just leaving her panties. I slipped my fingers beneath the rim of her panties down near the front of her cunt and moved then slowly back towards her asshole, fully expecting and hoping to find a nice pile of shit. My fingers found the hair of her ass and inched towards her hole. Her hole was open, and my finger easily slipped into her hot rectum. There was a small amount of excrement littering the crotch of her panties and more clinging to the area around her asshole, but there was not nearly as much as I had hoped to find. I went back to the car and stripped, and then returned to the grove. I then untied the rope and lowered her body to the ground where I stripped off her dress and pulled down her panties to around her ankles. I then draped her body over a crate that I had brought along for that purpose and fucked her up her asshole. I shot off almost at once and then felt very sorry for her. Oh, before I took her body down, I forced myself to lift up the pillowcase hood and look at her face. The face was swollen and a little mottled. The eyes were closed and swollen at the temples. Her mouth was open and her tongue was visible but not protruding very much. I was sick at the sight, but I left the hood off because of the blood, which I didn't like. After a few minutes, I got on her again and fucked her ass some more. It was still hot in there, and I shut off quickly once again. Then I stripped her out and threw her clothes into a pile. I then carried her body over to where I had rigged up a toilet seat between two crates, and I sat her limp body upon it. I then went down beneath the seat and stared up at her cunt and asshole, and fantasizing that she was in the act of shitting or pissing. After a while, I tired of this and left her body in the toilet seat and went back to the car where I slept. After a while, I went back to her and for the first time noticed that she was getting cold on the outside but still warm on the inside when I fucked her asshole again. This time, I left her nude body sprawled out on the ground with her ass sticking up in the air, sort of like she was kneeling. I went back to the car and went back to sleep, again, feeling sick to my stomach. Later, I woke up again and got out and went to her and stuck my dick in her ass again. This time I noticed that not only was she getting cold, but it was also getting stiff too. I woke up cold and went to the car, leaving her laying on the pine needles after humping her hiney and then passing out over her dead nude body. The next time I woke up, it was nearing daylight. So I went and took her body, which was becoming stiff, down in the joints of her arms and legs, and dragged it over to the rope. I replaced the noose around her neck and hauled her up to see what she looked like in the gray daylight. She was too difficult to haul up very far, so I took her down and hauled her up on a lower limb where I could support her body as I was pulling it up. For the first time after removing her handcuffs, I noticed that her wrists were very bruised, most likely from where she tried to get out of her predicament just before she died. Earlier, I had lain beneath her and looked up her dress with a flashlight, but now, with her hanging there naked, she was not too stimulating. I went to the car and got a woman's slip and put it on her, Then, as she was suspended from the rope, I stood on a crate behind her and screwed her ass from behind, but it was hard to keep her still on the end of the rope because she was wanting to swing out. Her body was cold by this time, and it was exciting in another way, being able to fuck her cold corpse. I got off inside her ass once more, and then, since it was getting light, I took her down and wrapped her up in a white sheet and took her to the car. I dumped her body in the trunk and picked up her things and wadded them all up except her panties, pantyhose, and slip, which were soaked in her piss. I wanted to save these for souvenirs. I drove to another deserted spot and took her corpse out of the trunk wrapped in the sheet. I half-dragged and carried it about a good 200 yards into the bush along a dike. She was very heavy now, and it was real work just to move her. When I got there, I decided I wanted to dump her corpse. I opened the sheet and rolled her out, now noticing that it was full daylight and that she was still wearing one earring and a gold chain. These I took and threw into a canal. Her clothes I also threw into another canal, and then I rolled her corpse down the side of the dike to a palmetto thicket. In the daylight, her corpse was very stiff and cold and grotesque. She had large bruises on her legs from where she probably kicked herself during her death throes. This, together with the distorted face and her bruised wrists, made her appear very unattractive. I propped her up as best I could and stuck it in her asshole again, and then turned her over. For the first time, I really noticed her auburn V covering her cunt. I forced her stiff legs apart as best I could and screwed face to face, which was not easy since she was very stiff and a little tight from the rigor mortis. I finally got my nuts off in her, and then I was exhausted for a while. I sat and then decided to dump her body in the canal. I pulled her body down to the water and pushed her in head first. Her auburn hair swam around as she began to slip beneath the hyanthus. Finally, the water came up over her butt and went into her asshole. I let her feet go, and she sank beneath the water. I went back to the execution site and cleaned up any traces of our having been there, and then went to a rock pit where I dumped her pocketbook and the sheet and a few rags and things. Then I went to Lum's and had lunch on her money and didn't enjoy it very much. About 2 weeks later, I was curious to whether she floated to the surface. I was horrified when I went to see where she was dumped. I saw her body swollen and bloated, floating there. She was face down, and her hair was covering her shoulders. Her ass was sticking way up in the air, and I was looking right at what had been her cunt and asshole. The maggots had evidently been at work on her, because there was a big hole from her cunt to the top of the crack of her ass, and she stunk to high heaven. She was putrid with all the flies buzzing and landing on her too. I poked her with a stick, trying to get her down under the lilies, but ended up having to pile lilies upon her to hide her corpse, which was a funny reddish color. Another few weeks and she was out from under the lilies again, and I tried to sink her with a few blasts from a shotgun. I would almost puke when I got a whiff of her corpse. It was that bad. I would always go there and beat off toward her, just out of range of the smell. Eventually, she began to rot away, and every now and then, when I could stand the stink, I would drag her out and try to mash it with a stick. It seemed even the maggots didn't want to have anything to do with her at a certain point. Anyway, finally I managed to break up the body and make it sink. I took the skull and let the ants eat her brains out if she had any, and then I pulled out all the teeth and scattered them over the county. The lower jaw I buried, the rest of her skull, with the face smashed in and the teeth out, I put in another canal some 10 miles from the rest of her body. All in all, she's probably scattered over some 30 square miles, and I hope that she will continue to remain among the ranks of the missing, even though there is no possible connection between us. Also found in Schaefer's mother's home were 11 guns, bags filled with live and spent cartridges, 13 hunting knives, sections of rope, and scores of softcore porn magazines in which he had modified the women to depict them as urinating and bound by ropes and hanging from trees. 37 black and white Polaroid photos showed women being hung and mutilated in undergrowth areas in Florida. Some images had Schaefer himself dressed as a woman, simulating being hung with fecal matter smeared across his buttocks. A letter dated July 20th, 1971, from someone who lived in Brunswick East, Victoria, Australia, contained scores of Polaroid images of a massacre that he had encountered in his travels that depicted women who had been disemboweled and mutilated with knives and axes. Inside a jewelry box, investigators found personal items such as jewelry, passports, and clothing belonging to several teenage girls and young women. Robert Ann Wilcox's driver's license and a passport belonging to Colette Marie Goodenough, who had been missing since January 1973, were found in this jewelry box. There were also teeth and scattered bones found on the property as well. These belonged to at least 8 victims. At Schaefer's actual home, 2 human teeth and several knives and firearms were found inside a utility shed. A blood-stained white pillowcase, which had been washed, was also found. Jessup's suede purse was also in the possession of Schaefer's wife that Schaefer had given to her that prior November. On May 18th of 1973, Schaefer was formally charged with first-degree murder for the killings of Place and Jessup. While being held before his trial, he was subjected to psychiatric examinations, and it was found that Schaefer suffered from paranoia, psychosis, and acute sexual deviation. He viewed himself as an eliminator of women who he deemed immoral. But overall, he was mentally competent to stand trial. Schaefer was sentenced to 2 concurrent terms of life imprisonment. Even at this point, Schaefer was still proclaiming innocence and that he should be sent to a psychiatric hospital as opposed to prison. On December 3rd, 1995, Schaefer was stabbed to death on the floor of his cell. He had been stabbed over 40 times about the face, neck, head, and body, with his throat also being slashed, his right eye destroyed, and several ribs fractured. His body was discovered after a fellow inmate informed staff of his death. A 32-year-old fellow inmate named Vincent Faustino Rivera had killed Schaefer following an argument over who received the final cut of hot water from a dispenser days prior to his murder. Rivera never admitted to it, though, and it is suspected that he was really killed because he was rumored to be an informant. Many people say that he finally got what he deserved. Jessup's mother was satisfied with the news of his death, saying she knew it would happen sooner or later. Gerard Schaefer was a sick man. He had dark obsessions and disgusting interests. He acted upon these obsessions many times. He wrote about them. He drew them out. He was a horrible man who tormented these girls before and after their deaths. He isn't as famous as Bundy or Gacy, but he is just as notorious, and perhaps even more deranged. People should know his story, and the story of these poor girls. Yet, he has faded into obscurity. Executive producers for this episode are Christine Rivera, Beth Davis, and Dusty J. Hicks. Associate producers are Paul Hodge, Noah Schultz, Chantel Sizlik, Jay Rawlings, and Terry Burke Wolin. Producers are J.D., Trent Gobble, Devin Dean, Jan O'Donnell, Lisa Perello, Alicia Knight, Laura Shin, Maria Celine, Chris Owen, Justin Ware, and Beth Esselman. This story was researched and written by Dorothy Jari, edited and narrated by Dave Jari. For an unfiltered, interactive version of this episode, hosted by Dave Jari and Garrett Quarter, follow Criminal AF, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow Criminal AF Pod on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Signing off from Studio Chloroform, keep your head on a swivel, and stay safe till next time.